Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tate Modern. My name is Marco Daniel. I'm curator of public programs here, and I'm delighted to see you all here this evening for this very special event. Anthony McCall is doing an artist talk for us. He will be in conversation with critic and historian Max Ozzola. And this, of course, is followed by a very special screening of Anthony McCall's line describing a cone 2.0, the digital version of his famous and classic line describing a cone. Now, what makes this occasion so particularly special is that the two works, the analog and the digital version, will be shown in parallel. So it allows for a great comparison of the different textures of the different media, of the two versions of this piece. I don't really want to say very much about Anthony. He's going to give a talk that will last about 40 minutes. That will be followed by Max Ozzola talking for approximately 10 minutes as a response to Anthony's presentation. But perhaps the one thing that I should draw your attention to is, of course, that at the moment we have two great opportunities to see Anthony's work here in London. He is on show at Sprüd Magers and at P3 Ambika. Sprüd Magers, he has works on paper at P3 and Beaker, and this kind of great concrete hall. He has got vertical works. The other thing that I thought is worth reminding you all of is, of course, that he is one of the 12 artists selected for Artists Taking the Lead, the Arts Council England in collaboration with Arts Council Northern Ireland and Arts Council Scotland. Olympic commissions for 2012, where 12 artists each represent one of the regions, and Anthony McCall's column will be the piece representing the Northwest region. I very much hope that we will hear more about Anthony's work, both historically and, of course, future works or works in progress at the moment. And without further ado, I will hand over to Anthony McCall now.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm going to talk about the vertical works first, and then go on to talk about two public commissions. I began making vertical pieces almost the same time that I started making art again, around 2000, 2001. And so I was making horizontal and vertical, but because a 10-meter tall space is not so easy to find, I actually was showing all the horizontal ones first, so it's now seemed as if these came later, but in fact they were running in parallel with all the horizontal pieces. This was actually Between You and I, which was shown for the first time by Peer at the Round Chapel in Hackney in, I think, 2006, I think. This is the maquette for the installation at Pier 3. It's a big 100-meter bunker, and the pieces are, there are four different pieces, and they're arranged in a line down the diagonally down the space. They look a little bit like this. This was an installation in Milan. There's always a dark room, a computer, a video projector, and ambient mist. That's pretty much the basic conditions for a piece. Before describing briefly each individual piece in the show, I thought I'd just make some general comments about the differences between the horizontal and vertical. The the horizontal pieces incorporate the body in a very different way. They absorb the body, the spectator, all the way down the length of the beam, from the projected image down to the projector. There are also two sides. There's always a left and a right with the horizontal pieces. And when you look down the beam at a horizontal piece, the drawing, the projected animated drawing that's the basis of the entire form, is behind you. And so you have to look at the drawing, you have to turn around and, with your back to the volumetric form to look at the drawing, and then reverse that when you're in the space itself. And this is a very distinct thing that happens. By contrast, when you're looking, there's the form itself. You turn around and you see the drawing, and you go back to the form. It's a back and forth thing. With the vertical pieces, on the other hand, you sort of see the volumetric form and the drawing at the same time. And I think I was very struck the installation yesterday thinking about it. That actually, I mean, I'm not sure what the right way to look at the vertical pieces is. I think they're in some ways, they present a kind of a problem, because it's not clear where the piece is, whether it, you know, considering you can see everything at once, and whether you should stand with your neck craned looking up toward the projector, or looking down, or looking across. The other thing about the vertical pieces is that they tower above your head, and you can't interrupt the beam. That's a very... very clear thing that happens with the horizontals is that somebody can stand in front of the beam and the piece can disappear entirely. There appear to be there are kind of two references for the vertical works too. One of them is, I suppose, architecture. They're tent-like enclosed chambers. And the apertures in the membranes become rather like doors. The other thing, of course, about them that's very architectural is that the duration is continuous. The object is there all the time. The other reference for me is that they are quite figural. I began referring to them as standing figures soon after I'd made the first vertical piece, and realized that there is a kind of very traditional, upright, figure-like quality to them. This shows quickly the relationship between the footprint on the right and the volumetric object. And I've always thought of these... footprint has become a sort of precise term. It is literally the footprint on the floor where you stand, and the real body is the form towering above you. As I've said before, I always think of these forms as being somewhere between sculpture and cinema. But whatever else they are always still just drawings. And drawing is somehow the center of every piece. There's a very limited graphic vocabulary. It basically boils down to straight lines, circles, traveling waves, and a new form that I've developed recently, which is a circle wave, which combines the properties of a circle and a wave at the same time. The thing is that I found that if I have more complex graphic forms, they're indecipherable in three-dimensional space, and so they kill the sculptural or the volumetric effects. So I've never found myself short of forms. Speed of motion. The speed is very, very slow. Slow enough that when you first encounter the projections, the first thing you notice is not the motion. You don't see it moving to begin with. I found that was the best way to do it, because if I found that if you have motion that's too fast, if it moves quickly, our tendency is to stand stock still and to watch and to wait, which is the opposite of sculptural looking, which involves moving your own body around the room and around the form. And so my rule of thumb is that the spectator should be the fastest object in the room. Another thing is that my structures are always cyclical, which is to say that the motion returns to where it started. And so that you have a kind of a continuity through time. You have a kind of process of continuous mutation, but there's no development at all. So it's in continuous motion, in a sort of present tense shared with the spectator. I'm going to now just go briefly through the four pieces and just talk about the structure. The first one I'm showing is Breath 3, which was made in 2005. And it's just consists of one ellipse, which appears to be breathing in and out, and a traveling wave, which passes through it. This is about, this animation should last about a minute. So the waveform is actually traveling through the frame, while the circular elliptical form is staying in one place. And the rules of engagement demand that when one hits the other, there should be still just one continuous line, and so some of the elliptical form is made to vanish. The next piece is You and I, and that's made of a also an ellipse and plus a traveling wave which is bisected by a rotating straight line. Rotation appeared to be the best form way to make a straight line move in three-dimensional space, and it alters the pockets of space by the way it interacts with the other two forms. The elliptical form is expanding and contracting at the same time that it's also eclipsing the other form. So it's gradually removing it. And this process of eclipse then repeats itself with the traveling wave form eclipsing the ellipse. Meeting You Halfway, which was made 2009, is even simpler. It just has two identical ellipses, which are expanding and contracting at different speeds. Again, you have that process of eclipse going on. The ellipse on the left is eclipsing the one on the right. The leading edge that performs that eclipsing process changes angle during the process. This is called Meeting You Halfway. And the fourth one, final one, is called Skirt. And this uses a new form I referred to earlier called the circle wave, which combines the properties of the circle and the traveling wave into one form. And that's the outer form. And superimposed onto an eye form, which is made of two elliptical arcs. And the eye form is moving through the circle wave form. I'm quite deliberately not talking about what happens when you look at one of these or engage one of the forms, partly because, I have my ideas about it, but in a way that has to do with the relationship between the forms and the spectator. And people bring a lot of very different experiences to looking at them, and they're often talk of a very rich group of associations. And I feel uncomfortable broaching that because I feel that's just the other half of the equation, but not my half. It's not that I'm not interested in it. And it's just that it is, in a way, I felt thought it was more useful to talk about structure at this point. And then maybe we can talk about the other in discussion. I'm going to pass on now to talk about two public commissions that I've taken on. Well, one still in the isn't exactly finalised yet, the first one. That's the first one I'm going to describe, which is for the city of Auckland in New Zealand. I was asked to make a proposal. There was a competition. Asked to make a proposal for a disused, decommissioned cement silo on the waterfront, the industrial waterfront of Auckland, which, like many cities, is in the process of changing its function. The industries have moved away, and the silos and storage tanks are gradually being demolished. But they're leaving this one as a memory of that moment. And I was asked to make a proposal for it. You can see the silo there over on the left. Auckland Harbour is an enormous, extensive harbour. Large city. The most interesting thing about it for me was when I discovered that the silo received the sun directly from dawn until dusk, winter and summer. I'm going to interject a remark or two, but actually this was made to present early on to a committee that I wasn't going to be present to talk to, so it's kind of tries to be fairly self-explanatory. It's not the whole presentation, but I've just picked out some salient parts of it. So there are actually four vertical cuts in the skin of the silo, which has immensely thick concrete walls, reinforced concrete walls. And these cuts will be regular points, four cuts, which will allow the sun to come in all day long. So as the sun moves around across the sky, I'm going to go back to the earlier one. The sun moves across the sky. It'll enter first the 90-degree aperture, and then it'll move around. It'll enter the 30-degree one. For a moment, there'll be two planes of light. Then it'll leave the 90-degree, and move on to the 330, and so on. So you get 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, moving around the cylinder, internal cylinder, which is the receiving chamber for the planes of light. And the beam, of course, is some 20 meters tall. Yes, this is when one of the sun is coming in. The sun becomes the projector, essentially. I had imagined that the duration of the sweep would be something like 2 or 3 minutes, very slow. Having made the proposal, I then began to realize there was something very familiar about it, discovered that, in fact, it was a kind of fusion of three different pieces that I'd made very early on. This was long film for ambient light, which was a 24-hour cycle involving electric light and daylight coming in the windows, which variously at different times of the day would be either the aperture of a projector, and at night they became screens for the electric light that was shining from inside. That was from 1975. Another piece called Room with Altered Window. Some of you may have recognized the shaft of light in a picture in that presentation. This maps, this watercolor maps the progress of the plane of light across my studio, coming through a slit in the window. And the third piece was Found Solid Light Installation from 1973, which was simply a map, a requisitioned map of England showing where all the lighthouses were and the direction in which the beams pointed. In the last 5 years, I've made a number of proposals, and they always seem to involve dead infrastructure. Silos, bridges, tunnels, docks, all that kind of thing. All infrastructure that's lost its previous purpose and does not yet have a new one. Now, before I describe the final piece, I want to just talk a little bit about mist. It seems that I've always used it, right from the start. I used to use a smoke element in all my fire performances in the early 70s, mid-70s. This was Landscape for Fire in 1972. This is Smoke Without Fire, also in 1972. And the use to which I've put it really most consistently, at least in the last 10, 12, 14 years, is as a means of making visible the solid light films. Without the haze machine, which creates something, a thin kind of mist, like a sea mist, you wouldn't have a volumetric form. And so it's a sort of vital ingredient. It's the most difficult ingredient. I mean, in any installation, getting the haze levels right and the direction of the haze and organizing the mist in such a way that it works with the weather of the room, the air currents that are in the installation space. That's always the most complicated thing. So I spend a lot of time thinking about it, mist. And yet it's, in a way, invisible. When it works, it's kind of invisible. and for the last 5-6 years, I've had a running discussion with a very old friend and colleague, a scientist, John McNulty, an inventor, about issues of visibility, enhancing the visibility, using the mist more effectively, creating a different kind of mist, and so on and so forth. How to improve that control. And it's this strange thing of it being one of the most important elements, yet it's utterly formless and most invisible. And eventually, I came up with a question out of these discussions, which was, can mist be shaped in the same way that light can be shaped? And John went off and started to think about this independently himself, and found that, and began looking to nature to see what forms existed that, in which mist was shaped, and found clues for himself in the physics of the waterspout. And many discussions ensued from after that point. And the result is that 3 years later, we now have a project in which we've succeeded in shaping mist and which we're realizing. And that's the 2012 project that was that Marco mentioned earlier. It's a piece called Column. It's going to take place in Wirral Waters, which is part of the Merseyside, and it's just over the river. The site is just over the river from centre of Liverpool. And it takes the form of a column of cloud that rises up into the sky. It's based on a very simple principle that warm air rises. But that rising of warm air is usually chaotic and the air just dissipates. But what we have is a column of spinning air that's spinning upwards. And there are suspended water droplets in the column which make it visible. It rises off the surface of a disused dock. And what happens is that we gently rotate the water with underwater pipes air. And then add heat. And this creates a centrifuge, and when the heat rises, as it must, it rises spinning, and that spinning drills a hole in the atmosphere above, the heavier air around it. And it also, the spinning also maintains its tubular shape. And so you end up with a very, very long virtual flue, a kind of a chimney, taking the warm air up into the sky, as far as the eye can see. At the boundary layer of this tube, you have warm air meeting cold air, and at that point, you have condensation, so you have a layer of cloud. Now here's a video of our most recent model. You can see quite clearly three aspects to this. One is that there's a kind of a hollow. You can see it's hollow. The other is that it's moving upwards quite fast. And thirdly, it's spinning. It has a helical spin. I like to think that these are the inverse of the solid light films, which you could describe as projecting a column of light through ambient mist. And these are the inverse of that, projecting a column of mist through ambient light. Structure. For the first 2 years, and really I still have this idea, but I'm not so sure about it, I had assumed that I would create a kind of structure by controlling the visibility of the column. And we'll have considerable control over that, we think. So it'd be the column will, as it were, appear and disappear in repeating cycles. But the form itself is going to be quite changeable. It'll be rather chameleon-like. It will be it will be affected by the vicissitudes of the weather, the relative temperature, the air pressure, the wind speed, the humidity, where the sun is, and so on and so forth. And it's occurred to me increasingly that, in fact, if all we do is to raise the column and leave it there, that, in fact, it will receive a structure. It will have a structure imposed on it by the weather in which it lives. It's made of the same elements of weather, really. So these are just studies. The one on the left is a column in estuary fog. The second one in driving rain. And the third in sunshine. And the Merseyside is an estuary region, and it has an enormous cavernous sky and constantly changing weather. And it struck me that actually this makes a far more interesting type of structure than to impose it as if none of that existed. This is what would happen if there are high winds. The column just simply bends to the wind but keeps rising. It'll rise as far as the eye can see, which in Liverpool could be as little as 50 feet, and could go in a bright, clear day up to several kilometres. And so on a clear day, it should be this little line in the sky could be visible for at least 100 kilometres, probably much further. So that's a 100-kilometre circle around Merseyside. One of the things that we would like very much to do, but it's not in our budget, but some point in the future we'd like to introduce it, is to create a form of internal illumination so that in those dark, wet, afternoons or at night, the form is glowing. It's like a translucent glowing tube, which of course gets it closer and closer to one of the vertical films. I think I'll stop there and look forward to the conversation later. Thank you.
Hello. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. So, I'll briefly respond to Anthony's talk. I'm very pleased to see so many people here at the cinema at the Tate. And I'm also looking forward to the discussion after my little 10 minutes response, because I think there's a lot we have to discuss and question and find out about together. Really. So I would like to talk about the experience of Anthony's vertical works, the standing figures, these strange encounters with a third kind. Anthony's work has primarily been read in relation to the modernist art and theory of the 1970s, usually starting with the film projection Line Describing a Cone, which we'll see later upstairs, and then spiraling into the present. And this approaches the work from the past forward towards the present. But what I would like to do this evening is to unravel the work from the present into the future. And by doing so, I have to pass by the very narrow passageway and address issues that so far has been avoided in the writing on Anthony's work. I want to see if we can place the work in relation to a new thinking about entity, collective identity, maybe something like secular spiritualism and transcendence. And quoting an interview with the filmmakers Graham Allard and Stephen Johnson, who are here tonight, Hal Foster writes that the spiritual dimension is difficult for a materialist humanist like McCall to discuss. Bodies and interactions and exchange are not divine ideas, he has stated simply. But he does not deny that it exists. So I'm wondering why the cautiousness in thinking about the spiritual dimension. Yes, the vertical works in Ambika at P3, You and I, Breath number 3, Skirt, and the last one's called Meeting You Halfway, bring to mind the modern sculptures of the Bauhaus artist Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, and of course Albert Speer's Cathedral of Light for the 1936 Olympics. But can we read the community-building experience of light, monumental height and abstract science, not as dangerously manipulative? That is my question. Can we try to decolonize and uncondition our collective traumatic memory and see these characteristically modernist features, monumentality, light projection, and mass collectivity, as an invitation to think about the future, what will come after what we know in this thing called postmodernism? So what do the solid light sculptures project, that is, throw forward? What kind of language do they speak? What kind of effect do they create? Affect, not effect, affect do they create? What kind of community is created in P3? Under which conditions do we come together? What is the common and what's the shared? What brings us together in a post-ideological world? I believe that the vertical works give us an opportunity to rethink these issues. But the postmodern condition and its insistence on transparency and visibility and contextual analysis and semiotics may not be the right school of thought for this kind of analysis. So take a stick and draw a circle in the sand. The line on the ground is an ancient form of signification and demarcation, symbol and ritual at once. Like children's games in the schoolyard, the vertical light sculptures are rooted in collective communication and the ritualistic performance of the sign and the mystery. The huddling around the fireplace, the gathering in front of a ritual object, the communal experience of the film. Here we are again performing ancient rituals of signification, social order, and spiritualism. And let's just entertain the idea that they are not necessarily always manipulative, controlling, and repressive. Just for the fun of it, can we imagine a unifying form that can solidify postmodernism's floating sign, render it from porous and transparent to solid and opaque? And I use the term opaque here in relation to Edouard Glissant, for whom the condition of opacity becomes the basis for the practice of self-authorization. So I agree that the vertical works are self-referential and narcissistic because they are like self-enclosed systems, but not in the Greenbergian tradition, in that they are like film as film, pure films that do not refer to anything else but themselves, which is the cinematic apparatus. But I would like to propose that they're self-referential, like an intruder or like the other that can never assimilate, or like aliens whose systems and raison d'être are not made for the planetary species. A kind of futuristic opacity is what I read in the sculptures and the signs they throw on the floor. And I also agree that the works are cinematic, but for me, the only thing that the standing figures have in common with cinema culture is the collective experience of a projection in a social space. So I would like to argue that the work, as we see it today, did not originate in expanded cinema, from which it then grew into large sculptures. And here comes my Žižek moment. No, it is precisely the opposite. These large standing sculptures could only find form in the cinema space in the 70s and visited it temporarily before finding a more appropriate technological and contextual post-millennium niche, which is where they are now. So the inhabitation of the solid light sculptures in the film co-op culture of the 70s was not primarily causal or philosophical, but pragmatic, because there was no other space for them. And I think that the exhibition at P3 demonstrates that the matching discourse for the standing figures, for the vertical works, is not the modernist frame into which we try to squeeze them all the time, but it's something that's to do with the new era, maybe something that we can call meta-modernism or alter-modernism, or, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of thinkers who are just trying to name this new era. Like the German-American Slavist literary scholar Raoul Eschelmann, who wrote in his book Performatism and the End of Postmodernism, that the art of the new era generates a unified and aesthetically mediated experience of transcendence that radically challenges postmodernism's textual semiotics. And I just would like to give, I think it's four PowerPoint sort of points at how we can define this new thing of coming together under performatism, which, to be honest, I don't know why he calls it performatism. I don't think it really fits this term, but this is what he calls it. So Eschelmann says that the performative subject uses the sign as an act of belief. So the sign implies a symbolic dimension that is not reducible to empirical reference. And I see this in the work of Antony very much. It's like this weird shapes and forms that I have difficulty referring to. Of course, they're narrative, but they're also really just weird and strange and abstract. Eschelmann also says that the performative subject is a unified, holistic, whole subject that is closed off from the chain of signifiers and the order of language. And he cites the dogma film, The Idiots, as an example in which subjectivity and semiosis are no longer treated as context, dependent, but rather form closed and performatively realized wholes. So for example, one of the main characters, Karen, sits at her bourgeois family's dinner, but performs her what they call spassing, you know, this kind of, if you like, retarded gestures. And she is not assimilating. So McCall's standing figures, whose abstract signs, combinations of the line, the curve, and the wave, seem to resist or at least problematize textual analysis. The performative subject is always framed. It draws borders to create a quasi-sacral space in which an existing state can, under certain circumstances, be transcended. And this is really fitting for McCall's work, I find. And lastly, the performative subject is optimistic. It does not suspect evil beneath the surface or inside the alien. And contrary to Boris Groys's text, Under Suspicion, Eshelman suggests that it is not evil which determines the postmodern condition, but post-postmodern condition, but rather love, for love as the optimal condition of innovation enables any subject to be loved, that is, to enter with another alien subject into a whole, salvational space or frame. And this perspective, Eshelman claims, which is that of a sacralizing metaphysical optimism, means the end of postmodernism and not its continuation by other means. And of course, this also relates to Antony's new work. And while Hal Foster reads the role of the light beam in the vertical pieces as spiritual visions, such as the Annunciation of the Virgin, or religious experiences of ecstasy, like the communion of Santa Teresa, I feel them very much more like digital, we call them in German Mantel Madonnas, the Madonna of the coat, I think, in English, the medieval figure of the Madonna who wraps and unwraps her coat, the fabric of her body, around the human community, protecting and unifying it. And I think the titles support the view, this view. So performatism, its minimalist and anti-theoretical subject, is obviously unsettling for those of us who are trained in post-structuralist and hermeneutics, and is certainly, definitely a continental school of thought. But I appreciate Eshelman's attempt to tackle the question of transcendence and identification in a post-ideological era head-on. So to conclude, I would like to propose the phrase moving sign frames, as a way to describe Antony's work in light of what I just said. Moving sign frames suggests a way of framing the subjects within the space of the sign that is always moving, always changing, and repeating its cycle over and over again, which might be an interesting way to think about collective transcendence today as something definite but process-based. And I'd like to discuss these ideas and Antony's presentation with you now together. Shall we open to the audience straight away? Yes, we're happy to receive comments, criticism, questions, suggestions, proposals, complaints, appraisals. Yeah, there's Jean and then it's André. Mm-hmm. Microphone.
Maxa, you've given an extraordinary sort of take on Antony's work, but I wonder, could you just rehearse some of the main ideas again in a telegrammatic way?
Because I'm also struggling with the ideas. It's just that the vertical works are an obstacle to me because I can't think of them in this kind of 70s way. There's something else there. So they're like an obstacle. So I have to find different ways to analyze them. And I came across, you know, different texts, but this Raoul Eshelman text. And I thought, oh, this really works. Okay, so what happened in Egypt? Collectivity, that's really grassrootsy. What kind of community can we take from this? Anthony's work, which are these celestial beings, but then at the same time, they're also really abstract. So anyway, you wanted a telegram. What I got from the text was the framed subject. So it's definitely the idea of transcendence is in a way artificial. It's artificially packed and wrapped up. So for example, he quotes American Beauty as an example, where in the first scene you hear the voice of the main character from the dead. So this is already framed as something artificial in which you can create that narrative. Then the subject, he says, is also like very simple-minded and stubbornly simple-minded, like the, and I don't quite know how to take that, but like the idiots in the Dogma film, in that they resist any kind of dissolve in the textual analysis. Yes, they're optimistic, so he's taking this from Eric Gunn's theory of generative anthropology, which says, you know, in the postmodernism, there's this theory of victimization, which comes from the Holocaust, and now this has to change into something that's not a victimization, something optimistic. There's also this idea as the phallus of the unifying element rather than the castration. Anxiety. Yeah, this is the, there's 4 or 5 points. I think I forgot one, I can't remember now. But I'm struggling with it as well, and at the same time I'm also drawn to it because I can see that he's really daring to say something that, especially in this country, is a taboo. Yeah, we don't talk about this idea of a new collective identity because we're so scared of it because of the past or the class system. I don't know. I mean, we can ask the audience about that. And then there was Andre.
Yeah. I like you, Maxi, your comment on reference to futurism. And also I wanted to add that Russian poet, like futurist poet Olga Rozinova, she was thinking about something the same in I think 1910, before she died very young, about these projectors and to create sculpture with projectors. And I also was thinking about this form of pyramid and cone, because it's kind of a new kind of reference, not like to a new kind of reference to cinema. I mean, this archetype of something extraterrestrial, something that exists beyond the Earth in space, and people perceive it as a pyramid or as a cone. And nowadays, a lot of the spiritual sects that create these pyramids to cure people and so on. So, and in like in blockbusters, you can see all these projections through sky that reminds of Anthony McCall's sculptures. So I was thinking something about that. And in case of these sculptures that now exhibited in London, you cannot see the source. You cannot see how it appeared comparing to horizontal projectors. So it's what I wanted to add. Probably you can comment also.
Well, I wonder how Anthony feels about these futuristic projections.
Yeah, probably because...
I think it's probably my place not to comment. But I mean, the thing is, you know, I agree with what Max was saying earlier about the break with the cinematic orientation. It's a very simple physical shift from horizontal to vertical, which I haven't entirely worked out, except it's very hard to actually, when you start trying to explain why it feels so different, it's very, you find you don't have the language for it. But it undoubtedly is a different kind of object. It's identical to a cinematic projection. It's 10 meters tall, 10 meters wide. and yet it's in the territory is more unknown.
In the horizontal cinematic projection, though, you see the projector. It's easier to see the projector, and here, as you said, Andre, it's the projector is in the ceiling, so you can't see it.
It's not only seeing the projector; it's knowing you're in cinema.
Yeah.
It has that traditional. Mm. You have an audience and the beam, and you have a screen, and you have a projector. Mm. It's that connection which is severed with the vertical ones, I think.
Cool. I like the reference. Thank you. There was a comment over there. Is the mic?
We may have kind of covered a lot of what I was about to ask, but I was just interested in the comment about how the filmic element in the 70s in relation to cinema was a kind of a necessity rather than anything, you know, deliberate or conceptual. I suppose I wanted to get a bit more into that kind of that space and just think about and ask Anthony what he thinks about, you know, the future for this and what the relationship is between the work and film as an element, you know, film as a medium, because obviously now we're going digital with the new one, so how do you see, you know, film and cinema as being an integral part of the work, or, you know, I just wanted to kind of discuss that.
Well, you know, when you talk about film, of course, you are talking about a medium, and then that gets tied up now with the loss of the medium and 16mm labs going out of business and so on and so forth. Cinema is an entirely different idea, which is a social structure for looking at and talking about moving images, looking at with other people and talking about them. And in those terms, you know, the digital, the shift from film to digital isn't really a terribly significant shift when you look at it in that way. Which I think is the right way to look at it. And then another shift has occurred for me in the last few years, which is, in the 70s, I definitely saw my work and it was understood as being part of a cinematic discourse, a oppositional one, perhaps, experimental film, avant-garde film, whatever you want to call it. And everything that was done was seen as a poke in the eye at Hollywood, really, put it really crudely. And now, when I started again, after a 20-year pause, I was really more struck by the sculptural half of the equation, which I had tumbled into, really, in the 70s, without really actually taking it on board. That interests me a lot because it involves considering bodies in space. The bodies of the spectator becomes part of the subject matter of the work. I was about to say something else, I've lost my thread. Well, I'll leave it there for now, if I may.
Mm. Yeah, I guess for me it was... because the theories of the 70s totally contradict the work, which is great. You read the kind of, you know, these famous quotes that you wrote for Experimental 5, I think in 1975. This film is real, it's not referential, the time is real, not referential, there's no illusion. And this is all, we can say the opposite now. Yes, it's totally, there's a great illusion. Because I don't know whether this is solid or transparent light, and I still surprise myself going through the doors, the open chamber, yeah? Into the light sculpture, because the illusion of the solidness is so great. And yes, there are actors, I'm the actors, I am photographed in the piece. And so there's this, the work doesn't live up to the theory, which is great, because it means that the work can transcend this frame. And so I've just always wondered, so there must be more than modernists, film theory that was developed around structural film.
I agree with that, yeah. Actually. When I went back, started to look at the early films again, I mean, my entry point for the new work was this. I started to look at the early films, particularly the Cohn films, there are four of them. And one of them's called Cohn of Variable Volume, a very normal title for the time, very descriptive, very matter-of-fact. And the way I thought about it, I was simply trying, I made a cone, a projected cone of light that was expanding and contracting at different speeds. I was astonished when I looked at it around 1999, 2000, to discover that the object was breathing. Mm. And that realization gave me a sort of new entry point for the new work. I was still going to do all the same things, make solid light projections that incorporated the spectator and so on and so forth that happened in real time. But this time I felt I had subject matter. And my obsession with, and well, interest in just the duration and the way it affected how people looked. You know, you make something very short, then you have to have an audience to see it together. You make something very long, and you fracture that audience into individual visitors. That sort of thing was of tremendous interest, but... and then this time round, seeing the breath, and being that much older, I think, duration suddenly took on a whole new meaning, which had to do with mortality, rather than the theory of time, mm-hmm. or something like that.
Mm. Yes. There's another question for you.
This is addressed to Anthony. You've said that the works exist somewhere between sculpture and cinema. But what I've heard you also say, which I thought was found very, very interesting, was that at the end it came down to being drawing, just drawing, only drawing. You made something, you said that it was sculpture, somewhere between sculpture and cinema, but in the end for you it was drawing, it's drawing. Mm. Mm. Did I hear you say that?
Yes.
Because I, a couple of years ago, Avis Newman organized a conference at Tate Britain on drawing. And there was an extraordinary presentation by the philosopher Alan Badiou. And what he had to say, I think, really fits with your claim that in the end, the work is drawing. He suggested that drawing was in the age, in the post-medium, it's post-medium, post-format. It has absolutely nothing to do with pencil on paper. It is post-medium, post-format, and it's an attempt to make an inscription of a trace, of a lost trace, of a lost event, some kind of supplement of excess that's happened, that's lost, and one has to make urgently, with some kind of fidelity, a trace of that event. And that's what drawing is. And it can take place in any kind of phenomenological trajectory, any kind of medium. It's post-format, post-medium, in other words. And I think this fits, in a way, your practice. Because you work in many different disciplines and mediums, even though you can sort of isolate it down to being between cinema and sculpture. But in the end, it's an attempt to inscribe something, perhaps lost, you don't know quite what it is. Mm. But something's happened, and there has been some kind of fidelity. So anyway, that's...
Well, thank you very much. That's a very interesting comment. I won't say much, except that it's also the process of making. In the end, it always is a pencil in my hand, you know, one's hand. And that's very simple, which is very reassuring. And the development of the work goes through a series of processes, all of which do involve drawing.
Yeah. Now, can I just add one more thing, Maxa, as you're chairing it? I can't really develop this, but I know that there's extraordinary work being done by Peter Sloterdijk on atmosphere and weather and the kind of ambient texturing of space that you use mist to perform. And it's very, very interesting. I don't know how to begin, but this is really quite extraordinary. And I think that you talked about when you with your spiral going up into this extraordinary drawing across the skies, you said it has a helix formation. Mm. And I think that in all the works, and I won't say much more other than to throw this out, that this helix is a Möbius band. And particle physicists have shown that in botany, anatomy, and in the cosmos, this movement of flow produces always a Möbius band. And I think this is something present in your work.
I think Thank that's you. Really important, Jean, and this is also your special area, topologies. And Sloterdijk draws up all these amazing new topologies. Let's say we have the Deleuzian crystal, but we also have the Sloterdijkian foam and bubble theory. And this is all these new organic forms that help me to think outside, you know, say, modernism. And I'm very grateful for this comment, and I will email you the
Thank you.
Reference. But it's, I think it's really very interesting because your work relates to physics and these kind of substances. And I think they're really helpful tools to get us out of this, in a way, dead end of thinking always in binaries.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, there's a comment at the back.
To come back, Maxa, to your discussion of collectivity. I mean, Anthony, I think in many ways your work perhaps was rediscovered against a backdrop of a general interest in the art world in participatory practice and collective practice, and in new discussions about, you know, what cinema space, cinematic space can provide after its presumed death. But I also wonder if you could maybe backtrack to some of the work you were making in the 70s, like Argument, and your involvement with films like Sigmund Freud's Dora, which is very, very radically different than the solid light projections. Similarly, take it back even further to, I mean, Max did refer to the Bauhaus, but this idea of the Moholy-Nagy light projections, a lot of the light projections that were being made at the time, and maybe more specifically the connection of that moment to the De Stijl movement and the discussions about social collectivity that were going on then. And I think, you know, Max had talked about these as almost conceptual works that could exist throughout time and just inhabit different forms in any given decade. And I think there may be some truth to that. But I think to ignore the work from the 70s in particular, like Argument and Sigmund Freud's Dora, would maybe be unfortunate in this particular discussion.
So where would you place Dora in relation to this work?
I'm not sure. I just think given, I mean, there was a strong interest, obviously, in psychoanalysis at that particular time, and you were drawing on a theoretical framework that evolved from that subsequently. Mm. So I think they are related somehow, but I'm not exactly sure. I don't know if Anthony has any comments to make, but I think whether those films still hold a place in your mind or your activity at the Collective for the Living Cinema in New York in the 1970s, whether these things still figure in your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, I can say some sort of autobiographical things about it. The discourse around the co-op here and around structural cinema amongst some practitioners was really quite seen, it was thought as a kind of oppositional politics in relation to cinema. And, you know, I don't know how much that holds water now, but if one looks at it. But at any rate, that was the sense that one had. And that did really lead quite fluidly for me into Argument and then Sigmund Freud's Dora. I had already by then brought this series of solid light films to an end because I had discovered that they were invisible when shown in any spaces but downtown spaces, which threw me into a bit of a crisis. And but also because the political discourse, I was really beginning to discover it, as a matter of fact. I didn't really know too much about it before that. And collective work seemed to be the right way to do politics, if you like. It's you know, to act politically is to act collectively. And it's a way of organizing. Argument was intended to be an organizing structure. The problem there was that my colleague Andrew Tindall and I recognized that we were in some kind of ghetto in which we were only showing work to one another and to nobody else. We had no audience, in fact, and that this was a big enough problem to make a film about it, which we knew would bring together other filmmakers, because that's what they always did. And so we tried to turn that problem of the collective ghetto into a political act by making a film which was a text which was designed to be discussed by an audience of filmmakers. And then Sigmund Freud's Dora opened up that process, was a more explicitly feminist film and involved a larger collective of friends, two women, two men, two women to me. And that actually succeeded where Argument didn't, in attracting two new audiences, not only an avant-garde film audience, but also a feminist audience and an audience interested in psychoanalysis. But of course, that also led into a whole other set of problems. That led straight into the academy. Mm-hmm. So out of the avant-garde into the academy, a new set of problems, you know. Mm-hmm. In any case, I think I've said enough. Mm-hmm. I think that's... But I will say that I think working as an individual artist is a different kind of process from working with a group. Very different.
Yes, that's fine. Yeah.
I wonder. I found your take on Anthony's work extremely thought-provoking, but I still am not quite sure what to make of, and whether I've heard you correctly, whether you see it on the side, because you've abandoned the modernist, post-structuralist, or structuralist trajectory, whether you brought back a kind of unifying humanism.
Yes, exactly, that's the problem.
And if you think that, I don't know whether this is a problem for you or not, and whether you actually, whether collectivity, and love has to be thought in terms of this being together, in terms of unification, as in terms of subjectivity and collectivity. This, I don't know, and whether this is a new form of humanism, whether the transcendence can only be thought in these terms in the post-postmodern moment. Is this what you're saying? And is this a symptomology, do you think? Is it a critique that you're making, or is it, are you more ambivalent, or are you celebrating this? And do you think this is instantiated in what way by Anthony's work?
You know what I'm doing with it? I'm just putting it out, and then I'm discussing it like we are discussing it now, and that's it. More I'm not doing at the moment, because I have to wait and see what happens. I don't know whether to celebrate it. I have to read more of the work around it as well, and then slowly form an opinion. But for now, I don't. It would not be wise to make to judge it. Mm-hmm. But yes, exactly, but this is the, I can see the dangers, they are there all over, you know, the red lies. I can see them as well. And yet I'm trying to, just testing it out. Mm-hmm. It's like a test site. Mm-hmm. What did the others think? I mean, I know it's always overwhelming after a long talk, but we have, microphone can stay in that role. And then there's a man there, and then
we
in 5 minutes
yeah.
we will introduce the screening. Yes.
You made a comment.
Speak into the mic.
You made a comment I found very intriguing, and I sort of have two questions about it. One, you said that the aperture is like a doorway for you, and I was wondering if you could comment on that a little bit more, and I'm also wondering if you see the vertical works as having cosmological significance or making a contribution to theories of cosmology.
Well, the last question first. I don't know anything about cosmology, so I can't. I can't say. But I mean, the thing is, it's why I'm always very careful about talking about what happens when you look or you engage one of these words. Because I'm well aware that I don't own light, the meaning of light. You know, people are bringing their own ideas with them. And because I don't know about something doesn't mean it isn't there. I mean, in other words, I'm not fully responsible for what's there. And I welcome that. I have no problem with that. The first question about apertures, yes, that just came out of a sense that these forms appear to have architectural references as well as sculptural ones, and perhaps given the scale, the architectural one may be more fertile, you know. So instead of cinema and sculpture, maybe you have cinema and architecture. And and you see, you find yourself using terms that are also architectural terms. And the apertures which horizontally are openings, if you like, or just apertures, take on a kind of door-like form. They open, they close. They, you know, they yawn open and they close, they shut. They seal the form off, they open it up. I've also noticed that adults, children alike, show an enormous respect for those apertures. They go through them and don't go through the through the membrane, if given a choice. So that's quite interesting. That it would appear that we all treat them as doorways, to some degree.
Nice. Last question at the back.
Was that me, by any chance?
Yes, I think it was you.
Hello. Good evening. I'm here as an ignoramus. I had never heard of you until I suddenly opened up an email, okay? Even though I should have maybe, now that I look at what you've done, the work you have actually put into this world. Now, everything that you've been talking about as concepts is vaguely familiar to me, but many of the words you use I don't understand. Nor am I familiar with many of the references you make. But nevertheless, what I've been seeing in your work has been revelationary to me sitting here right now, because I've been dying to say something, and I'm probably going to make something, statements that are very embarrassing maybe. But I'm looking at the past and maybe a little bit of the present in your work. I can see the architectural elements very much. I can see nature in your work as well. The way a tree slowly releases its buds into the atmosphere and they've become leaves, and then suddenly, very drastically, they die and they fall off. Or the act of war as part of a human interrelationship that creates history, where civilizations are built up and suddenly they fall apart in a very drastic moment. And I am wondering what the future holds as far as your work is concerned, because I can see its relevance to our living environment. And maybe, so what I'm saying here, instead of waffling too long, because I must probably carry on, if I'm allowed, but I won't. What I'm saying is, where could we apply your work in real life so it becomes an everyday event, something that we live with and don't have to come to an to see as a process that we have to consciously be aware of, but we accept. And that is maybe the future that I'm talking about. Anyway, can I leave it there? Because otherwise I'll start getting a little bit confused even to myself. Apart from everybody else.
Thank you.
It's very beautiful, I think. Do you want to respond to that, Ant?
No, I thought I'd like to accept it as an interesting observation, but I don't any have any idea where my work's going from year to year, and other than to say that the some of these pieces, some of the commissions will become permanent installations, and therefore will go through time and can be seen anywhere. Anytime. I think I don't know. Thank you, though.
Yeah, it was very beautiful. I think that's what art should, that's exactly what art should do. Right? Change your day, your life. How can you take it into your daily concerns and problems as an event? I think it's very beautiful what you said. We wanted to quickly introduce the screening to you, and then we have to leave this here, this space, in exactly eight minutes. And Marco is very strict about time, so we better stick to it. We're going to show line describing a cone, 60 millimeter version upstairs for 15 minutes. Then this will be joined by, do you want to do it?
Yeah. We have a half an hour. Line describing a cone is 30 minutes. And it was made in 1973 on 16 millimeter film. And I've been under not pressure, but I've been asked many times in the last few years if there was a digital, if I digitized the film, because it's just easier to show than 16 millimeter. Increasingly for museums and galleries, it's very difficult for them to put on film shows. And Line Describing a Cone, some of the later 70s films really can't be digitized because they're so integrally about projection and about the film medium. But I was troubled, so I had no ideological objection to to making a digital version of Line Describing a Cone. The problem was that I didn't think it was very interesting to simply copy it digitally and thus create a rather poor film version. It seemed much more interesting to remake the film digitally because what that meant was that it would be more perfect. The film version was made using a hand-drawn line and traditional animation techniques, which I wasn't very good at since it was the first time I'd done it. And it's supposed to show a dot turning into a circle over 30 minutes. However, the film had to be animated in two halves. And everyone who knows the film knows that at a certain point, the two halves don't quite meet. And plus, the line is of slightly uneven thickness. To go back, what I did was to eventually go back and make I remade the film digitally. And I made the film that I'd been in my mind's eye before I made the first Line Describing a Cone, but which I didn't precisely succeed in making. So we have the second version is perfect in the sense that the line is of the same thickness, everything meets. The speed is very even. There's no scratches on the emulsion and so on and so forth. And it's produced and it's called, to distinguish it and to make clear that it's not replacing the film, which still exists in the world, it's called Line Describing a Cone 2.0. And we thought, tonight will be the first showing of Line Describing a Cone 2.0, and we thought that it would be quite interesting to project them side by side and to see what the differences are from the point of view of looking at the film. And so what we're going to do is to project the film for 15 minutes, and at the halfway mark, 15 minutes, we're then going to begin projecting the digital version. So we'll have, in each case, 15 minutes of the one medium and or the one format, and 15 minutes that are shared.
Great. I'm looking forward to that. I think Markus will tell us how to get there. And then.
Thank you very much, Max, and thank you, Anthony. The screening in the East Room will start at 8:30, and the East Room is on level 7. We've allowed a little bit of time for final preparations, but also because it takes a while to get up there in different batches in our lifts. So please make your way up to level 7, turn right and walk into the corridor towards the East Room. Now, because of capacity, we can only let 120 people into the East Room. There will be an opportunity, of course, should viewers not see the entire duration of the performance, for people to come in on a one-out, one-in basis. However, we also are planning to have a second screening that will take place at 9:15. So please either make your way up now and wait for the 8:30 start, or feel free to return with your ticket at 9:15.